People who are poor and want to progress, you give them a hand, the trafficker said. Back in Jalisco, by then, more and more young men were turning to Chiva for that hand up. All around the town were the signs of what could be accomplished by selling heroin. Women's clothing stores, law firms, new markets. Beer dispensaries were a six to a neighborhood now, and they were new ones with wooden floors, security cameras, and computerized cash registers. Large houses owned by young men were everywhere. No one could build such houses on the wages made working sugarcane. At the Feria del Elote, cell leaders sponsored basketball teams, importing semi-pro squads from Monterrey, Mazatlan, Hermosillo. Each team had at least one African-American, hired to improve the team's chances. In the town's horse parade, which once featured common farm animals, saddles worth $5,000 sat atop horses worth four times that. The Jalisco system expanded during the 2000s to include families from all over the region. The pioneers from the Tejeda Sanchez clan had for many years only recruited people that they were in some way related to. That changed after Operation Tar Pit sent close to dozens of these workers to jail. The U.S. heroin market was expanding, fueled by Americans' addiction to prescription opiates. Jalisco bosses quickly reconstituted their cells, bringing in workers now from families they were not related to. Over the next few years, as Jalisco cells multiplied, their demand for labor grew voracious, and the opportunity to work heroin was now open to many more families. Most of a generation of young men found work in it. One driver I spoke with, just beginning a prison sentence, told me he began to think of going north when a heroin trafficker he knew in his village built a house with an automatic garage door. Old people stood in amazement and watched it open and close. He saw other drivers, guys he grew up with, return and buy beer for everyone in the plaza. Girls flocked to them. Without land or prospects, he signed up too. It was like a little weed that just keeps growing until it invaded the whole village, and eventually it didn't matter what your last name was, said a former driver I spoke with, who went by the name of Pedro. Anyone with a desire to go up and try his luck could do it. To most of Ranchero, Mexico, Chiva was a disgusting thing. But like the song says, dirty money removes hunger too, Pedro said. When my brother went up north, my mother was saying, I don't know how you can sell that garbage. But when she saw the money, she was very happy. Cell leaders had to recruit drivers from new ranchos, and especially from Nayarit's capital city, Topeak, nearby. The new recruits no longer had family connections to the heroin pioneers. What's more, they had work already. They were painters, construction workers, bakers, butchers. But these were dead-end jobs in Mexico, and humiliating when so many other young men had new trucks and houses and money for the banda. So, before long, driving a major U.S. metro area with your mouth crammed with balloons of heroin was a viable economic option, kind of like SSI in eastern Kentucky, for a much larger swath of restless young men in and around Jalisco, Nayarit. In several Jalisco neighborhoods, virtually every able-bodied young man had gone north to sell heroin. The working-class Landareñas and Tres Puntos neighborhoods, not far from the town's rodeo arena, were among them. The flat neighborhoods, with some still unpaved streets, were a mix of modest houses of concrete block, mechanic shops, mom-and-pop markets, small beauty salons, and crowing roosters. The neighborhoods became sources of labor supply for the Jalisco heroin stores in the United States. Selling heroin up north became fashionable, almost a rite of passage, for Landareñas and Tres Puntos young men. Most would learn little of America beyond strip mall parking lots and the Jalisco heroin hubs of Columbus, Charlotte, Denver, Portland, and Salt Lake. Pedro had done many dead-end jobs in Nayarit. His father taught him to hate drugs. Pedro never listened to the ballads, the narco corridos, that recounted how traffickers died in a blaze of glory. But I was tired, he said years later, of work that led nowhere. A brother-in-law offered work selling heroin. Soon several of Pedro's brothers went north, too. "If they need anyone, let me know," Pedro told his brother-in-law. By then, Pedro had watched the business spread across Jalisco. He remembered as a boy seeing a man who'd just returned from the United States. He was sitting atop a fine thoroughbred horse that no one in town could afford. He was drinking beer, this man, and was the subject of gossip around town. Since then, at least 24 of Pedro's friends had gone to work as drivers in the Jalisco heroin system as it spread across the United States. Every one of them went with the dream of earning enough to start a car shop or open a tortilla stand or buy a taxi. Not one ever did. True, they built houses and bought clothes for their families, those Levi's 501s especially. But they spent the rest on beer, strip clubs, and cocaine, and walked the streets of Jalisco for a week or two, the object of other men's envy. When their money dried up, jonesing for that quick cash, they went north as heroin peons again and again. The Jalisco labor pool never dried up. Young men were always eager to return and push heroin, strung out on the high of coming home a king. When he got a call from a cell boss, Pedro figured he would be different. He wanted to earn enough to open a bakery. The boss sent him and another young man to the border and paid for them to cross with a group of migrants. The other kid was headed to Minneapolis to sell. Pedro was sent to Columbus, and from there his boss sent him to another city that was deemed virgin territory. He was given certain rules. No blacks. His boss feared African Americans. Once a customer brought a black customer along, the boss pulled the gun and told them both to get out and never come back. The kids Pedro sold to were all white, always ready to try out their high school Spanish. "Hola, amigo. ¿Cómo estás? Me gusta mucho la cerveza." Pedro and his co-workers found a furnished apartment. Pedro didn't want to stand out or drive more than he had to. When he wasn't working, he was in the apartment playing the Xbox. He made $1,000 for a few weeks of work. Then he was arrested and convicted of trafficking. Authorities shipped him to prison. There he studied for his GED at 25 cents an hour and passed. He also worked as a prison landscaper and cook, making $23 a month. It was enough to afford him a television, a radio, and his own food. By the time he was released, he had made $900, almost what he had made selling heroin. They sent him to El Paso, where an officer took him to the bridge leading to Ciudad Juarez and told him to start walking. "Don't come back," the officer said. A month later, back home, Pedro received a letter from the prison. It contained a check for $430, the remainder of what he was owed for working and studying for his GED. On the day of Operation Black Gold Rush, a year after the arrest of the junkie bailiff in Nashville, hundreds of officers fanned out across 15 U.S. cities, gathering up Sanchez clan heroin crews. 138 people in all, drivers, telephone operators, suppliers, as well as numerous local addicts. That day, federal court looked like a hospital ward. Junkies were throwing up, sweating, and falling off their benches. "If we didn't arrest them, they were going to die," Mabry said. Marshals rushed doctors to court. Several junkies had arraignment postponed because they weren't fit to understand the judge. Like Operation Tar Pit 6 years before, Black Gold Rush showed the vast expanse of the Jalisco system, in this case operated by just one extended family. Nashville was connected to Ohio, to North and South Carolina, to Indiana, Kentucky, and to several states out west. Indicted in absentia in Tennessee, Alberto Sanchez, Uncle Beto, remains in Mexico, possibly Guadalajara. As happened after Operation Tar Pit, the Sanchez heroin cells quickly reconstituted. His networks, and those of his family, are believed to encompass most of the state of South Carolina, including Myrtle Beach, where police have 6 times dismantled the Sanchez heroin cell, only to see it return each time. DEA sources and traffickers themselves tell me Sanchez family cells operate also in Denver, Charlotte, Indianapolis, Salt Lake, Las Vegas, Cincinnati, Columbus, Knoxville, Memphis, Reno, and Portland, Oregon. Whole new labor pools were becoming available in Nayarit as young men in dead-end jobs signed up for driving stints. Up in America, new, younger, and wealthier customers were emerging everywhere. It was a good time to be a heroin dealer. The criminal case. Southwest Virginia. Late at night on October 24, 2006, John Brownlee, the U.S. attorney in Western Virginia, received a phone call at home. On the line was Michael J. Elston. Elston worked in the U.S. Department of Justice while Alberto Gonzalez was Attorney General for President George W. Bush. Elston said he was calling on behalf of a Purdue Pharma executive. The investigation Brownlee had approved into Purdue Pharma and its campaign to market OxyContin was then 4 years old. The case was assigned to the tiny Abington, Virginia office, near Kentucky and West Virginia, a coal mining region where hundreds of people had died of OxyContin overdoses. The office issued hundreds of subpoenas, scanned stacks of documents into a database, and interviewed dozens of people. By 2006, Brownlee's staff believed they had evidence that the company had knowingly misbranded OxyContin as virtually non-addictive. In Purdue focus groups, doctors worried about OxyContin's addictiveness but yearned for a long-lasting and less addictive painkiller. The company that produced a non-addictive painkiller would dominate the pain management market, and that is exactly what Purdue tried to do, Brownlee testified later. Purdue marketed and promoted OxyContin as less addictive, less subject to abuse and diversion, and less likely to cause tolerance and withdrawal than other pain medications. Despite its ad claims, Purdue provided no study to the FDA, investigators later noted, that supported those claims. The company taught its sales force that oxycodone was harder to extract and thus abuse than other drugs, though the company's own study showed that wasn't true. In 1995 tests, the company found that 68% of the oxycodone could be extracted when the pill was crushed and liquefied and drawn through cotton into a syringe. In fact, addicts I spoke with said it was easier to extract the drug from an OxyContin pill than from other milder opiate painkillers, such as Vicodin or Lortab, because OxyContin didn't include anything but oxycodone, while the others also contained acetaminophen or Tylenol. The company's sales staff said in promotional meetings across the United States that OxyContin's 12-hour timed-release formula meant there were fewer peaks and troughs in euphoria when compared with immediate-release opiates. This was a crucial point. Intense euphoria followed by an intense crash is what produces the cravings leading to addiction to opiates. If OxyContin didn't cause these extreme peaks and troughs, then its salespeople could claim to physicians that the pills carried less risk of addiction than short-acting opiates. I spoke with several doctors who said the graph showing OxyContin's purported mild peaks and troughs of oxycodone and blood plasma were among the most convincing data that Purdue salespeople produced. But federal investigators later said that these graphs were incorrect and falsely exaggerated the difference in euphoric effect between Oxy and its short-acting competitors. Purdue phonied up those graphs to show a steady level of oxycodone in blood plasmas, said Paul Hanley, a New York City plaintiff's attorney who brought a class action lawsuit against Purdue. The true graph shows an incredible spike, then boom, you go straight to the bottom. Purdue supervisors taught salespeople to tell doctors that patients using up to 60 milligrams of OxyContin could stop abruptly without withdrawal symptoms. However, federal investigators found that company officials knew of a 2001 British study of osteoporosis patients who described suffering withdrawal when they stopped using OxyContin. Even after receiving this information, federal investigators wrote. Supervisors and employees decided not to write up the findings because of a concern that it might add to the current negative press surrounding OxyContin. As I was writing this book, I contacted Purdue's media representatives, requesting an interview with someone at the company about the 2006 criminal case. I inquired about its ad campaign and about how OxyContin was selling lately, among other things. I also asked for interviews with Dr. David Hanix, author of The Concept of Pseudo-Addiction, and with Dr. Curtis Wright, who had been a part of approving Purdue's application while he was at the FDA. A company spokesman sent the following. For more than 30 years, Purdue Pharma has developed opioid medications to alleviate the debilitating pain experienced by millions of people. As leaders in our field, we are acutely aware of the public health risks that can arise from the misuse and abuse of these medications. We are working with policymakers and healthcare professionals throughout the country to reduce the risks involving opioids without compromising the medical care of people suffering from chronic pain. Purdue is developing innovative technologies to create pain medicines in new forms that include abuse deterrent properties, making them unattractive to drug abusers. These medicines are designed to provide patients with pain relief when taken as directed, while also deterring abuse by snorting and injection. These new approaches do not prevent abuse, but they are a step in the right direction. We encourage a transition to abuse deterrent technologies over time, but it must be accompanied by greater societal efforts to reduce the demand for non-medical use of prescription medications. In 2005, the federal prosecutors in Abington, Virginia, who were preparing the case against Purdue, subpoenaed Dr. Herschel Jick up at Boston University. A deputy sheriff delivered the papers. Dr. Jick ignored the subpoena at first. He was too busy to be bothered. Then a federal prosecutor called. They needed him to testify before a grand jury, she said. Something to the effect, Dr. Jick later remembered, of a drug company using his 1980 letter to the New England Journal of Medicine as proof that their drugs weren't addictive. Herschel Jick was perplexed. He had no idea what she was talking about. What did all this have to do with him? I told them I wouldn't go, he told me. But they threatened to put me in jail, so I slept on down there. They had me on the stand asking me irrelevant and obtuse questions for 2 hours. Dr. Jick then returned to Boston, and with that, he exited our story. His tiny letter to the editor, in the back pages of the New England Journal of Medicine, having helped ignite, quite unintentionally, a revolution in American medicine. In Abingdon, the case against Purdue proceeded. John Brownlee filed criminal charges against the pharmaceutical company. He set October 25th as a deadline for Purdue to accept a plea agreement. In the plea, the company would admit to one felony count of false branding of OxyContin or face further charges. In later testimony before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, Brownlee said Michael Elston asked him during his phone call to slow the case, postpone the plea agreement. Elston later said he was calling on behalf of a superior, who in turn received a call from a Purdue defense attorney asking for more time for the company. Brownlee thought about the request. It was a delicate matter. His political career showed promise. He was being mentioned as a potential candidate for state attorney general, even governor. Still, he saw no reason to postpone the long and complicated case. That afternoon, he had received approval from DOJ higher-ups to proceed with it. He said he told Elston to go away. Brownlee signed the plea agreement with Purdue the next morning. 8 days later, his name showed up on a list compiled by Elston of federal prosecutors recommended to be fired. 9 were fired. In the end, John Brownlee was not one of them. But, he testified the next year, he believed his inclusion on the list was retaliation for not delaying the Purdue settlement. The Purdue episode lingered amid the Bush administration controversy, in which top attorney general officials were accused of political meddling in the work of their far-flung prosecutors and recommending some be fired for not complying with what were perceived as political orders. Elston later resigned. An attorney for Elston told the Washington Post later that there was no connection between the phone call that night and Brownlee's name appearing on the list of prosecutors recommended to be fired. John Brownlee spent another year as the U.S. attorney from Western Virginia. In 2008, he resigned to seek the Republican nomination for state attorney general and lost in the primary. Talk of a future gubernatorial bid wilted. His political career stalled. He is now in private practice. However, Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty to a felony count of misbranding OxyContin. To avoid federal prison sentences for its executives, the company paid a $634.5 million fine, among the largest in the history of the pharmaceutical industry at the time. Three executives, CEO Michael Friedman, General Counsel Howard Udell, and the by-then-departed Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Paul Goldenheim, paid $34.5 million of that. Each pleaded guilty to a single misdemeanor of misbranding the drug. They were also placed on probation for 3 years and ordered to perform 400 hours of community service. In July 2007, the Purdue executives appeared in federal court for sentencing. Lee Nuss, the mother of a Florida man who died of an OxyContin overdose, rose to speak. "You are," she told them, "nothing more than a large corporate drug cartel." About this time, over in southern Ohio, Dr. Philip Pryor had left private family practice to devote himself full-time to his specialty in addiction medicine at the Veterans Administration Hospital in the town of Chillicothe. Pryor was one of the few addiction specialists in southern Ohio, and this made him something akin to a battlefield medic. The area around Chillicothe had seen drug problems before, but they'd never involved opiates. Not long after the Purdue campaign hit full swing, however, Chillicothe and the surrounding towns began seeing patients addicted to OxyContin. Many of them used hundreds of milligrams a day as their tolerance grew. New liberal prescribing put oxys everywhere. Pill mills sprouted like fungus. Soon, opiate pills were the party drug for small-town kids who, in another era, might have been building bonfires and getting drunk. Then Pryor watched in amazement as heroin came to town. Heroin was as foreign to these rural white communities of southern Ohio as extraterrestrials. Wasn't it an urban drug? For blacks in Baltimore or D.C.? Puerto Ricans in New York? It had never had anything to do with Appalachia. This heroin, too, was like nothing Pryor had ever seen, even in movies. It was sticky and dark brown like rat crap, yet potent and, above all, cheap. It was called black tar. In Columbus, Mexicans were delivering it by car, like pizza, at prices that were a fourth of what Oxy cost, and offering volume discounts. In Chillicothe and towns around Fairfield County, every addict became their salesman, looking for new clients he could parlay into enough orders to make a trip to Columbus worthwhile. From Fairfield County, the news marched south, down through a region where OxyContin had already tenderized a generation of folks to opiate use. Athens County, 90 miles southeast of Columbus, had seen almost no heroin ever. By 2008, 15% of the admissions to a treatment center there were related to heroin, and almost all were injecting it. In 2012, the center was treating more heroin addicts, mostly for black tar, than alcoholics. And so it went. OxyContin first, introduced by reps from Purdue Pharma over steak and dessert and in air-conditioned doctors' offices. Within a few years, black tar heroin followed in tiny, uninflated balloons held in the mouths of sugarcane farm boys from Jalisco, driving old Nissan Sentras, to meetups in McDonald's parking lots. Others, too, got in on the trade. Black guys from Detroit and Dayton discovered southern Ohio and brought powder heroin. Philip Pryor was now knee-deep in what was unthinkable a few years before: rural white heroin junkies. "I've yet to find one who didn't start with OxyContin," he said. "They wouldn't be selling this quantity of heroin on the street right now if they hadn't made these decisions in the boardroom." Part 3. Now it's your neighbor's kid, Nashville, Tennessee. Out on the northwest side of Nashville, Tennessee, Judge Seth Norman had come to expect phone calls to start pouring in around late January every year. The legislature comes back in session in January, Norman said. The calls come from state legislatures, each with the same problem: an addicted son, a daughter, a brother-in-law. My nephew down in Camden, you think maybe you might be able to help? I get those kinds of calls, he told me while we sat in the office adjacent to his courtroom. Most of the country's 2,800 drug courts are set up to divert drug users away from jail and prison and into treatment somewhere. Seth Norman runs the only drug court in America that is physically attached to a long-term residential treatment center. He takes addicts accused of drug-related nonviolent felonies, theft, burglary, possession of stolen property, drug possession, and puts them in treatment for as long as 2 years as an alternative to prison. Down the hall from his court are dorms with beds for 100 people, 60 men and 40 women. I visited Judge Norman's Nashville facility one overcast fall afternoon, because this epidemic was not the same as those of the past. For the first time since the years after heroin was invented, the root of the scourge was not some street gang or drug mafia, but doctors and drug companies. I went to visit Judge Norman because I wanted to see what changes widespread addiction to a drug, usually associated with the ghetto or barrio, might have wrought in America, now that virtually all the new addicts were rural and suburban white people. Seth Norman is 80 and possesses snow-white hair, a genteel southern manner, and a drawl to go with it. He started the drug court/treatment program in 1996 and built it almost single-handedly by scrounging beds and ovens and lawnmowers from Tennessee state surplus. Part of his efforts included frequent visits to the state legislature, where his pleadings for more funding fell on deaf ears for a good long time. Norman would go to the lawmakers about his figures. The drug court and long-term treatment could keep most addicts out of prison, saving the state $32,000 a year over what it costs a prison to house an inmate. The drug court, he would say, boasted a recidivism rate of only 20% among those who finished the treatment program. Compare that with over 60% for those leaving prison, he told them. This was before the pill and heroin epidemic swept through. Most legislatures took drug treatment for soft-headed do-gooderism and held to the lock-em-up attitude that voters preferred in a red state like Tennessee. If Norman's experience is any guide, however, that hardline attitude has softened recently. It's taken 16 years to convince the legislature that it is cheaper to put them in drug treatment than to put them in prison, he said. The cost savings weren't what did the trick, though. Treatment has always been more effective and cheaper than prison for true drug addicts. What's changed, Norman said, is that no longer are most of the accused African-American inner-city crack users and dealers. Most of the new Tennessee junkies come from the white middle and upper-middle classes and from the state's white rural heartland. People who vote for, donate to, live near, do business with, or are related to the majority of Tennessee legislators. As the opiate epidemic mangled the middle class, these kids doped up and dropped out. Earlier generations of opiate addicts became self-employed construction workers or painters because that was all they could manage with heroin, and often jail, in their lives. With the new generation, time would tell how they would do, but it wasn't looking good. A large subset of these new young addicts had criminal records now. Many were on probation. A good number went to prison. Either way, their parents were realizing that life with a record was as stunted as life with an opiate addiction. Any dreams these kids' parents once had for them were now improbable. Even qualifying to rent an apartment was hard. With a criminal record, finding a job in the teeth of the Great Recession was almost impossible. Some parents were so worn out that they welcomed the child's departure for prison. But the opiate epidemic also made a lot of criminal justice reformers out of rock-ribbed white conservatives. This is what Judge Seth Norman discovered, The experience had, shall we say, modified state legislators' hard-line attitudes toward the proper role of rehabilitation in dealing with addicts accused of drug and property crimes. One thing that makes legislators more amenable to treatment is that it's hard to find a family now that hasn't been hit by addiction. Started out 15 years ago, very few members of the legislature had them. Nah, ain't nobody in my family going to touch anything like that. Not so anymore. Now they have seen it firsthand. Norman's no dummy. He named several dorms at his treatment facility for friendly legislators. Haynes Hall, Henry Hall, Waters Hall. When I visited, he claimed the support of the sitting governor and state directors of corrections, public safety, and substance abuse. Norman couldn't have imagined this when he was scrounging surplus sofas and coaxing pennies from elected officials in the late 1990s. But as the opiate epidemic ravaged white communities across Tennessee, it had a way of changing the minds of even the hardest hardliners. Signs of this were quietly appearing nationwide. The opiate epidemic was forcing judges to imagine new kinds of courts, veterans' courts, mental health courts, designed to treat the causes of what landed a suspect in a criminal case. In Ohio, the opiate epidemic had swollen the prison population beyond capacity. Prison director Gary Moore, appointed by Governor John Kasich, a Republican, told a newspaper that he favored expanding prison drug treatment and had done so in four prisons. He also suggested that he would resign if the legislature decided to build more prisons in response to the epidemic. Republicans across the country, in fact, seemed to be changing their views. In Texas, Georgia, South Carolina, and other states, GOP lawmakers were pushing for what the Wall Street Journal termed a more forgiving and nuanced set of laws. You're seeing this huge groundswell for criminal justice reform really being driven by conservative circles, said Chris Deutsch with the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. Conservative governors are starting to invest in drug courts. In the last 5 years, we're really starting to see statewide drug courts in every county. Texas opened drug courts and was able, therefore, to close prisons. Kentucky Congressman Hal Rogers, a staunchly conservative Republican, has become a strong proponent for drug courts since his district, which included Floyd County, had been hammered by prescription pill abuse. The epidemic of illegal drugs is by far the most devastating thing I have seen in my more than 40 years of public service, Rogers says on the front page of his website, where he also touts the 30 drug courts in his 24-county district. Kentucky State Legislator Katie Stein, a Republican, introduced a bill as I was writing this book that made it easier to charge a heroin dealer with the death of someone who died from an overdose. But key to Stein's bill was increased funding for addiction treatment and education. You used to think, oh, the heroin addicted, that would be someone in some back alley, someone I don't know, Stein told the local TV station. Now, it is your kid. It's your next-door neighbor's kid. Georgia Governor Nathan Deal heard recovering addicts tell their stories at graduation ceremonies from the drug court where his son is the presiding judge. They all have their own stories, but a common thread runs through all of them, Governor Deal told the Journal, explaining why he had tripled the number of drug courts in 3 years. They were given a second chance, and they had been rehabilitated. Several factors made this politically feasible in states like Georgia. Declining crime rates were certainly one. Stressed budgets during the Great Recession were another, though treatment has always been proven cheaper than incarceration. Yes, the fact that, coincidentally or not, this change of heart was happening among conservatives, just as opiate addiction was spreading among both rural and middle-class white kids across the country, though perhaps most notably in the deepest red counties and states. Drug enslavement and death, so close at hand, were touching the lives and softening the hearts of many Republican lawmakers and constituents. I'll count this as a national moment of Christian forgiveness. But I also know that it was a forgiveness that many of these lawmakers didn't warm to when urban crack users were the defendants. Let's just say that first-hand exposure to opiate addiction can change a person's mind about a lot of things. Many of their constituents were no longer so enamored with that tough-on-crime talk, now that it was their kids who were involved. So a new euphemism emerged: smart-on-crime, to allow these politicians to support the kind of rehabilitation programs that many of them had used to attack others not so long ago. Meanwhile, buoyed by his new purchase with Tennessee's political class, Judge Seth Norman had done some thinking. 4 or 5 drug courts like his could be funded with a 1-penny tax on every prescription opiate pill sold in Tennessee. After all, some 400 million of the pills were prescribed annually to a state of 6 million people. By the time I was leaving Nashville and heading again to Portland, where I had heard a Jalisco boy was just sentenced for the death of Tovi Sinyeyev, the Russian Pentecostal kid, no drug company had stepped up to endorse Norman's idea. Like cigarette executives, Portland, Oregon. Because every call means money, Jalisco boys never ignore their phones during business hours. Thus, Milwaukee police detective Tom Garrett was surprised that after calling the phone of a Jalisco boy known as Doriro for a half hour, no one answered. Garrett and his colleagues were now full bore into investigating the heroin overdose death of Tovi Sinyeyev, the son of Russian Pentecostal couple Anatoly and Nina Sinyeyev. A dozen harried days had passed since Tovi's mother found him comatose in his bedroom. Under pressure, his sister Alina told police that their dealer was a Russian Pentecostal heroin addict named Alexei Dzyuba. They put a wire on Alina. She called Dzyuba. Going through withdrawals and with her brother on life support, Alina met the dealer in a Safeway parking lot, surveilled by a dozen undercover officers. She bought heroin from him and passed him some marked cash. As he drove from the parking lot, officers descended and arrested him. With that, a strategy that Portland had adopted to combat the Jalisco boys was set in motion, named for a college basketball player who died in 1986 after using cocaine a friend had given him. A so-called Len Bias case is based in federal law. Under that law, a person who supplies drugs that cause a fatal overdose may be charged with a conspiracy that results in death, a charge that carries a 20-year prison sentence. Cops have to prove the person died from the suspect's drugs. A chain of custody has to be established. But if they can do that, they have a powerful prosecutorial tool, and one that was getting a closer look in many parts of the country as the opiate epidemic and fatal drug overdoses spread across the nation. One place that refined the strategy was Portland, Oregon. The benefit prosecutors see in Len Bias is that it allows investigators to work up a chain of drug distribution. To save himself from the Len Bias prosecution, a dealer needs to flip, and quickly, burning the dealer one link above him in the chain, hoping for leniency at sentencing time. The last man detectives can trace the drugs to faces the 20 years if convicted, a fateful game of musical chairs. Thus, a heart-to-heart takes place in an interrogation room. Investigators can't threaten a suspect, but they do tell him what he faces under federal law. "The tone in the room definitely changes," Garrett said. "You're not joking with them. It's a very powerful conversation." Speaking through a Russian interpreter, Dzyuba bridled at this idea. "People die every day for their addictions," he told his interrogators. He wasn't to blame for their choices. Finally, though, a defense attorney explained the situation. Dzyuba gave up the name of the junkie dealer he bought from. With that, Garrett and his colleagues began working up the chain. Dzyuba's dealer gave them the name of his supplier, who in turn gave them his dealer. This dealer, 3 levels up from Tovi, said he bought daily from a Mexican he knew only as Doriro. This is how, on April 12, 2011, Garrett and his colleagues began calling the number of a man from Nayarit they would later learn went by the name Joaquin Segura Cordero. They received no answer. They called through the afternoon. Nothing. Unbeknownst to them, Segura Cordero was at that moment being arrested by another department. Portland police had their own Len Bias death case against him. This one originated 3 hours away, in Bend, Oregon, where a kid named Jebediah Elliott had overdosed and died a couple months before. Both heroin chains led to Segura Cordero, who, as it turned out, was a kind of regional sales manager for a Jalisco heroin cell. Normally, as a Jalisco regional manager, Segura Cordero would have been insulated from the kind of day-to-day heroin sales that would expose him to arrest. But Segura Cordero had faced a classic small business problem, a labor shortage. "He had several runners arrested, so he'd run out of runners," said Steve Migrant, one of the prosecutors in the case. "He was having to expose himself. He was taking calls and making deliveries himself." Migrant is the Clackamas County prosecutor, deputized to try federal cases. Segura Cordero was his first Jalisco Boys case. By the time I spoke with him, a couple years after Tovey's death, Migrant sounded both harried and amazed by the Jalisco system. "It used to be you go into the ghettos to buy heroin from street corners," he said. "Now these organizations are coming to the neighborhoods, to suburbia. They come to you. That's unique to this organizational model. They're all coming out of Nayarit and all operating off of this dispatch style. Like the fishermen in Alaska, they work 7 days a week and go back home and play." The Segura Cordero case showed that Jalisco heroin spread for 150 miles around Portland. It went out to the quietest rural counties, where kids, addicted to pills, learned to drive to Portland, buy cheap black tar, and triple their money back home while feeding their own habit. In classic Jalisco style, every junkie became a salesman. The federal prosecutor who has done more Len Bias cases than any other, who worked out the kinks in the way these prosecutions work, is a woman named Kathleen Bickers. Bickers' first heroin cases in the late 1990s were of Jalisco cells. "We were doing the Nayarit guys, but we didn't really realize it," she told me. But in time, she saw the cells' connections to Nayarit and to each other, how they stretched from Portland across the West and out to Columbus and the Carolinas. Now she called the whole thing Corporation Heroin. "They are the Philip Morris of heroin," she told me in her office in downtown Portland one day. "They think like cigarette company executives. The corporate nature of the model, they depend on that cash flow. They're not going to go away because you incarcerate a few individuals. You have to cut the labor force off at the knees. You have to make sure the people from Nayarit realize, when you come up here, you may never go back, or it may be 15 years before you go back." As she spoke, I thought back to the conversation with that fellow in prison from whom I first heard the name of the town of Jalisco so long ago now. He lived in Portland, working legally as a mechanic as he watched the Jalisco system expand. "In Portland," he said, "I'd see the police grab people with 20 or 30 balloons, and they'd let them go. That's why people began to come to Portland, because they weren't afraid. They saw there were no consequences. We get caught with this, and they let us go." Word spread back in Jalisco that cells did well in Portland, and furthermore, arrested drivers were only deported. "More cells crowded into town," he said. This reminded me so much of small-town Mexican business culture. I once visited a village in central Mexico, Tzintzutzan, Michoacán. Tzintzutzan had at least 24 vendors, all selling the same kind of pottery on its main street. Once one person did well selling pottery, everyone started doing it. No one thought to vary the offering. The stores stretched for 5 or 6 blocks, with each selling identical pots and bowls, eager to undercut the other. Mexican small business culture, born of crisis and peso devaluations, was risk-averse and imitative. That described the Jalisco cells. They came and imitated those who'd come before. In so doing, they dropped prices and raised their potency, and the natural result, particularly as OxyContin tenderized the market terrain, was more addiction and overdoses. None of this was on a kingpin's order. It was something far more powerful than that. It was the free market. Portland's catch-and-deport policy was an important reason why. The policy was designed for the small-time street addict slash dealer, who city officials didn't want taking jail space for more serious felons. The Jalisco boys' drivers worked hard to look small-time. In reality, they were the only visible strands of large webs that sold hundreds of kilos of black tar a year across America by the tenth of a gram. So for many years, when they were caught, they were deported and faced little jail time and no prison time. As farm boys on the make, they drew a very different message from leniency than what these Portland officials intended. To them, catch and release looked more like an invitation. By the time OxyContin came to Portland in the mid-2000s, the city was famous back in Jalisco, Nayarit. The boys crowded into the Rose City. What's more, the arrival of OxyContin meant they no longer had to rely on the old street clients like Alan Levine. There are now many hundreds more to help jumpstart a heroin sell. The addicts were younger and wealthier. Seizures of a few ounces of heroin was big news a decade ago. Now, Bicker said, cops routinely found pounds of the stuff. Len Bias became Portland's new strategy to combat the Jalisco boys. In Portland, and for presumably the first time in the history of heroin in America, police began responding energetically, two or three detectives at a time, to a dead junkie in a gas station bathroom. The deceased's cell phone was mined for contacts that could lead them up the Jalisco ladder. Runners were no longer automatically deported. They were told they faced 20 years in federal prison. For Len Bias to work, federal, state, and local government agencies had to cooperate completely. The state medical examiner had to be willing to quickly perform an autopsy. The local DA had to give up the case if it appeared the feds had more leverage. Above all, investigators had to share information. This was because, unlike traditional Mexican drug organizations, Jalisco cells actually shared supplies, even with competitors. Jalisco cases tended to connect like webs. This was forcing investigators to discard turf battles. The ego of a narcotics cop is what makes them great, Bicker said. They're creative, innovative, persistent. They know how to dog a target, but they're very territorial. We constantly have to remind ourselves to break those barriers down, to think organizationally, and not just think that it's my case. You're going to go up a couple levels, and you're going to run into someone else's case. You get down to the dead people, and the cases all look like they're separate. But you work them hard and high enough, and you keep your mind open. You'll see connections. Joaquin Segura Cordero was one example. He was sentenced to 14 years in prison for selling dope that killed Tovi Sinyeyev in a suburb of Portland and Jebediah Elliott out in the Oregon countryside 150 miles away. Bickers had another case against two brothers from the village of Pantanal, near Jalisco, who were the ninth level up of a Len Bias chain. They faced life in prison because of the death of a young woman in Salem from an overdose of black tar that they were accused of importing. As one level led to the next, Bickers watched a web emerge that connected the brothers' alleged Portland cell to suppliers and cells in other parts of Oregon, Las Vegas, and Colorado Springs, and, of course, to Nayarit. From Bickers' office, I walked a few blocks to the office of a public defender to speak to an attorney who had agreed to talk to me as long as I left his name out of it. He had convinced many Jalisco boys that their cooperation was the only way to avoid 20 years in prison under Len Bias. The attorney had a standing order to detectives to call him immediately when a Len Bias case began. He supported quick cooperation with investigators, a controversial idea among defense attorneys. The value of your information is at its maximum the closer you are to the time of your arrest, he said. If you're in really quick, you can derive great benefit for your client. Still, he didn't see much effect from prosecutors' new strategy. The pills were so widespread. New kids were getting addicted every day. They were switching to heroin all the time. Against that backdrop, he figured, prosecutors were only temporarily disrupting the market. My dental hygienist came to talk to me, he said. Her son was involved with heroin to the point where he was stealing stuff out of stores. This is a middle-class person you'd think would never be touched by something like this. But it's so prevalent. It's almost like you were trying to stop drinking coffee with a Starbucks on every corner. No Scarface, No Kingpins. Denver, Colorado. That was a daunting thought. I kept it in mind as, not long after that, I stood in an apartment 1,200 miles away in northeast Denver, watching a thin kid with short-cropped hair tell detectives a story. Jose Carlos was a classic Jalisco boy. He was 21, and a faint mustache was trying to sprout above his lip. Shackled to a chair, he was shirtless, and nervously watched Dennis Chavez and a team of narcotics officers go through every bit of his apartment. The day before, a narcotics officer named Jess Sandoval had spotted a woman making heroin deliveries at a southeast Denver parking lot. When officers pulled her over, she gave up the apartment and Jose Carlos. So the narcs busted in. Jose Carlos said he'd been in town for only 3 months selling heroin. He owned to being from the town of Acaponeta in Nayarit. The cops asked who his boss was. He started tearing up and shutting down at that point. He'd been in Columbus, Ohio, and Charlotte, North Carolina. Working construction, he said. None of the cops in the room were buying that. But as long as he wasn't giving up anybody above him, they didn't care what his story was. The case, like hundreds before, would go no higher than this scruffy kid. His one-bedroom apartment contained nothing they could use against him. In fact, it contained almost nothing at all. A Walmart card table, 4 folding chairs, a small flat-screen TV, votive candles to the Virgin of Guadalupe, a pile of clothes, some DVD action flicks, and packets of Pizza Hut hot sauce. No bed, no sofa. No weapons, no cash either. On the table were balloons and a plate with only a couple grams of tar heroin. Jose Carlos, it appeared, supplied the Denver drivers with their balloons. There was a slight twist to this operation. The Jalisco cell had its addicts call a Denver number. Those calls were forwarded down to a phone in Nayarit, where an operator answered, then relayed the addict's order to a driver up in Denver, a heroin call center. This bust was small time by traditional narcotic standards. Yet, short of arresting the cell owner down in Mexico, the narcotics team, from Denver's District 3, was doing what probably harmed the Jalisco heroin business model most, raising its cost of business. The Jalisco system succeeded because it reacted to how American cops traditionally work drugs. Narcotics team found barren apartments and peons like Jose Carlos. The money and most of the drugs were back in Mexico. This deflated cops and prosecutors. Thus, more so than any traditional drug network in the country, the Jalisco boys were forcing law enforcement to rethink old strategies, particularly as the opiate epidemic took hold. The upper and middle class junkies scrounging for dope hung around District 3's trendy University of Denver and Washington Park neighborhoods. The Jalisco drivers were there too. District 3 cops didn't have the manpower or budget to work long undercover cases. Their approach to the Jalisco boys was simpler, born of necessity, and revolved around Officer Jess Sandoval. After 22 years as a cop and 16 working drugs, Sandoval had become curiously like the Jalisco runners he tracked. He was as inconspicuous as they were, and about as relentless. In many years as a crime reporter, I have never encountered a narcotics officer as low-tech as Sandoval. He uses only a department-issue flip-up cell phone and a 2007 Honda SUV. He works business hours because the department pays no overtime. He works alone. In his cubicle is a photo of the Lone Ranger, a gift from colleagues. He almost never uses informants, never buys drugs undercover, never works wiretaps. Instead, Sandoval trolls South Denver strip mall parking lots, searching for telltale signs of deals about to happen. Frantic white kids in cars, backed into parking spaces, their heads swiveling, surveying all that moves. He watches until the Jalisco runner passes, then follows both cars, calling for backup to arrest them down some side street when the deal goes down. "I find myself some days traveling all over the district looking," he said. Doing that, Sandoval made huge numbers of cases. His method is low cost and high volume, the law enforcement version of the Jalisco heroin system. True, he was arresting the drug world's equivalent of day laborers. They only had small amounts of heroin. They kept quiet, were deported, and were placed within a couple of days. But Sandoval's approach recognized that Jalisco cell owners were small businessmen. They were sensitive to cost, like every small businessman. They weren't Scarface-style kingpins, spending wantonly and living for today. Some cell leaders required their drivers to turn in receipts at the end of the day. They had to account for every dollar. So the way Sandoval saw it, each bus forced a crew chief in Nayarit to buy another car in Denver, find another apartment, and send another driver across the border. Each was a headache for a businessman who already had to make sure that his runners, 18 to 25-year-old males, most of them, didn't run out of supply, didn't party, didn't get anyone pregnant, didn't use the product they were selling. With each cell phone Sandoval confiscated, the crew chief had to reconstitute his client list, though soon the cells began keeping master lists of clients' phone numbers on a computer somewhere in Nayarit, Sandoval figured. "The more drivers we take off, the more desperate they get for drivers," he said as we circled the southeast Denver strip mall. Amid an epidemic, this was about as good as the cops in District 3 could do. New addicts graduated from OxyContin to heroin every day, and dope demand raged across Denver. Drawing from deep labor pools in Mexico, the Jalisco boys' system appeared impervious. Sandoval's busts were as cost-effective as any other strategy. Denver's District 3 narcs took heart, therefore, from small victories. A couple weeks before I showed up, one Jalisco cell owner, angered that several drivers had been arrested, sent up a guy to act as a consultant of a sort. The consultant's job was to accompany the drivers on their routes, study how they worked, and suggest ways they might avoid arrest. Officers arrested him, too. A parent's soul pain. Ohio. As I tried to chart the spread of the opiate epidemic, one thing dawned on me. Other than addicts and traffickers, most of the people I was speaking to were government workers. They were the only ones I saw fighting this scourge. We've seen a demonization of government and the exaltation of the free market in America over the previous 30 years. But here was a story where the battle against the free market's worst effects was taken on mostly by anonymous public employees. These were local cops like Dennis Chavez and Jess Sandoval, prosecutors like Kathleen Bickers, federal agents like Jim Kirkendall and Rock Stone, coroners like Terry Johnson, public nurses like Lisa Roberts, scientists at the Centers for Disease Control, judges like Seth Norman, state pharmacists like Jamie Mai, and epidemiologists like Jennifer Sable and Ed Soshi. I saw, too, that they were hamstrung. Sandoval and Bickers and Norman were limited in what they could accomplish as long as people remained silent and scary quantities of pills sloshed around America, carrying people to heroin. So, in time, my focus shifted to the families of those who died, people who were standing up to warn others. Such advocates were few. Most grieving families retreated in shame and never said a public word about how a son died in a halfway house with a needle in his arm. A decade in, with 16,000 fatal opiate overdoses a year, only a handful of parent groups had formed to do anything about this public health crisis. The marketing forces arrayed against these parents made their crusade quixotic. Their lone qualification for the task was a soul pain as relentless as the physical pain that opiates were now commonly prescribed to calm. But no one else was doing the job, and crying days away, arms around a photo album, seemed a waste. One of them was Joe Anna Crone, a woman with a soft southern drawl so common down in Portsmouth, Ohio. On my first glance at Portsmouth, Ohio, I found it hard to see much cause for hope. So many buildings were abandoned. So many folks looked dazed. So many others were on dispiriting disability. The town seemed infected with a pessimism and inertia that I associated with depressed Mexican villages, places that those aspirations left. I'm glad I kept going back, for in time, beneath that worn-out veneer, Portsmouth revealed another side. The opiate epidemic pushed the town to unimaginable depths. But the town where the pill mill was invented, where an OxyContin Walmart economy had taken root, a town savaged by economics for 30 years, that led the country into the opiate epidemic and that was flat on its back and forgotten, refused to stay down. I love a good underdog story. This one seemed exhilaratingly American. As I tracked signs of how the opiate epidemic had changed the country, one place I found myself returning to, a half dozen times or so, was Portsmouth, Ohio. And there I met Joanna. Several years before, on April 22, 2008, Joanna sat next to the hospital bed that was the end of what seemed to her such a fast road down. In the bed, tubes extruding from his body, lay Wesley, her comatose 18-year-old son. A mother of five and a substitute teacher, Joanna prayed with her childhood friend, Carrie, by her side. The two women had grown up in neighboring farms outside Portsmouth. Snatches of Wes's life appeared before Joanna as she cried and prayed some more. Living with his father, Wes began smoking pot at 13, and at 14 dove into the pills that were everywhere in Portsmouth. He was a football player and handsome. He was a linebacker and a ferocious hitter, and thus popular. So a lot of what he did was forgiven, and he got used to that. Football players were common among the new rural opiate addicts. Some got addicted to pills prescribed for injuries. Others, like Wes, took them at parties. By his senior year in 2008, as he starred on the field for Portsmouth High School, Wes had a minor criminal record. He dealt oxys from his father's house. He bought a gun for protection. One night, 5 weeks before graduation, he was high and partying in his father's basement with younger kids. As a lark, Wes put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger. He lingered on life support for 36 hours. 800 people attended his funeral. The family played Angel by singer Sarah McLachlan. His death was on the Daily Times front page 4 days running. 5 of his organs were donated. Wes wasn't the first Portsmouth kid to die. McLachlan's song, written about a junkie whose life slips away in a cold, dark hotel, was becoming a standard at youth funerals, the soundtrack to Portsmouth's swelling opiate epidemic. But ashamed families shrouded their children's passing in a fog of euphemism and palatable lies. One couple Joanna knew claimed their son died of a heart attack when everyone knew his drug use caused the heart attack. Coming on top of everything else that had happened to Portsmouth, the truth was just too painful. As in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, the newspaper was careful not to reveal too much about these deaths. Wes's death was like that at first. He died of a gunshot. The newspaper never said he was high on OxyContin, had been using off and on for years, sold pills, that his house had been broken into twice, and he bought the gun from a convicted felon for protection from robbers. That was the full story, and the one that Joanna Crone, sitting at her son's side, decided she would tell. "I was going to be honest," she said when I met her a few years later. "I wasn't going to try to hide what had happened. If I said it enough, maybe another family would never be in my place." A year after Wes's death, a high school invited her to speak. She told kids the full story. Another high school invited her. She brought pictures of Wes to a town meeting, showed them around, and told what there was to tell. Kids were dying everywhere in Portsmouth. Soon, grieving mothers gathered around her. It was like they were waiting for someone else to start talking. They put photographs of their dead children on an abandoned building downtown. That finally put faces to the town's unspoken curse. Families of dead kids found the freedom to talk publicly. It took a decade. But the first voice raised by a parent was that of Joanna Crone as she toured high schools in 2009, telling kids why Wes died. She formed Solace, a group for parents mourning the loss of children to opiates. Solace became the first parent anti-drug organization to grow from the opiate epidemic's ground zero. When Joanna and some mothers appeared at an attorney general's press conference in green Solace t-shirts, the media took notice. Joanna began getting phone calls from other counties. She realized then that kids were dying all over Ohio. Nobody had been talking about it. Joanne stopped substitute teaching. Solace was all she did. Chapters of Solace formed in 16 counties. She spoke in Brown and Knox counties, up in Chillicothe, in Ironton, everywhere except for the high school Wes attended, and that now offered a scholarship in his name. Portsmouth High never got around to inviting her. She grew overwhelmed one day, waiting to give a speech with her friend Carrie. They had grown up doing chores and swimming at the local pond, and as teens, sneaking a beer now and then. They double-dated, imagining how they'd marry and raise kids. Now in their 50s, each woman had a son dead from dope-related gunshots. Carrie's son, Kent, was murdered in 2000. Each woman also had another son strung out. Joanna's oldest lived in a trailer without running water. Carrie's second son had been to prison 3 times, and she had PTSD from 13 years of dealing with her 2 sons' addictions. The women had once found Carrie's son in a KFC bathroom shooting up. What had become of their girlhood American dreams? Joanna wondered. "We used to catch snakes in the creek," she told her friend. "Who would have ever thought that we'd be here together?" "I sought out Joanna Crone because I couldn't remember any drug scourge so ably abetted by silence." Cocaine in the early 1980s came with Colombians who shot up Miami strip malls, levitating the murder rate and inflaming the public. My first week as a crime reporter in Stockton, California in 1989, I walked a street lined by 2 dozen crack dealers. When I opened the front gate to a dilapidated house, the crackheads fled like roaches. Bloods and Crips came and warred across Stockton. One of their drive-by shootings paralyzed a toddler. I often wonder what became of her. She would be in her mid-20s by now. Next came methamphetamine, made in labs that exploded. Meth left users scabbed and twitching. None of that blight, violence, and outrage accompanied the morphine molecule as it swept the United States. As opiates quietly killed unprecedented numbers of kids, it was as if the morphine molecule narcotized public ire as well. That it began in voiceless parts of the country, in Appalachia and rural America, helped keep it quiet at first. To even see the plague required examining confusing and incomplete data. A generation of coroners had grown up unused to reporting on drug overdoses. The nuances of whether someone died from opiates, and if so, whether that was oxycodone, hydrocodone, methadone, or heroin, were sometimes lost. The signature location of this drug scourge, meanwhile, was not the teeming public crack houses. It was, instead, kids' private suburban bedrooms and cars, the products of American prosperity. The bedroom was the attic sanctuary, the shrine to the self-involvement dope provokes. It was their own little dreamland, though quite the opposite of Portsmouth's legendary community pool, where kids grew up in public and under 100 watchful eyes. Each suburban middle-class kid had a private bedroom, and the new addicts retreated to them to dope up and die. "We lived in our bedroom," said one woman in recovery. "You could have a big, huge house, but you could lock that door, isolated. everybody I ever got high with, it was always in their bedroom. It was privacy. Don't come knock on my bedroom door. Most kids also had cars, and when combined with pills or heroin, those vehicles were as destructive as those bedrooms. Their doting parents gave them these cars, which were necessary to navigate pedestrian-proof suburbs. But addicted kids